32 is. Good. A couple points before I really get started. I don't work for Amazon. This is the things they told me to say slide. I don't speak for Amazon. In particular, I can't make any promises about what they might or might not deliver in the future. I can say I hope they will do something, but that is me saying I hope they will do something. It does not mean that they are legally compelled to do anything. I signed an NDA, so there's some things I can't talk about. In addition to that, there's a lot of gaps in my knowledge of EC2, so there are some things that I just can't talk about. And I'll leave it to you to try to figure out which is which of those.
You broke it 2 weeks ago.
No, that wasn't me. I have found security problems in Amazon Web Services in the past, but I have published those on my blog. So no. So the point of this talk, EC2 was announced on August 24th of 2006. At that point, they only supported Linux. In fact, they only supported one version of Linux. I think it was Ubuntu. May 2008, they launched OpenSolaris. In October 2008, they made Windows available. And December 2010, I finally got FreeBSD up and working, available experimentally. So the point of this talk is to answer the question, what took so long? So for those of you who are not familiar with EC2, it is rent by the hour virtual machines built around the Xen hypervisor. EC2 stands for Elastic Compute Cloud. Amazon likes to abbreviate things. I think it was at one point EC squared, but now it's just EC2. A hypervisor provides virtualization to operating systems. This is rather similar to the way that operating systems provide virtualization to individual user processes. You have a CPU that needs to be shared. You have memory that needs to be shared. You have devices that you need to moderate access to. You don't want to have different operating systems writing over each other's data. If anyone remembers the debate about microkernels, essentially a hypervisor is a microkernel. And the world seems to be moving towards microkernels, or hypervisors, so essentially Tannenbaum does win that debate, even though it was 15 years ago. EC2 has a collection of Amazon machine images. Amazon provides some of these, and individual users can create their own images and then either have them remain as private images or make them public for everybody to use. Each machine image is essentially a disk image and some metadata that tells Amazon how to load this image. So there's a whole bunch of roadblocks I ran into trying to get FreeBSD working on EC2. The first problem is getting a kernel running. I mentioned before, when Amazon launched EC2, it only supported a single kernel image. Because Xen is a hypervisor, microkernel, it has only a very small amount of code. And all sorts of stuff that you have in an operating system is not included in the Xen hypervisor. One of the things it can't do is look inside a disk image in order to find a kernel to figure out how to boot it. So the way that Xen works, at least in the version I'm talking about here, is that you tell it, this is the disk image, and this is the kernel I want you to load. I mentioned before, Amazon machine images provide a disk image, not a kernel image. November of 2007, they launched support for Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Now, of course, Red Hat, being the big monolithic company it is, they like to do things the Red Hat way, which includes running a Red Hat kernel, not whatever random kernel it was that Amazon was running before. Which means, obviously, there's some way for Amazon to have different kernels that could be loaded. And about 5 months after that point, They've added support for specifying which kernel to load when you register an Amazon machine image. This is just the metadata. You can't provide a kernel there, but you can say, of the kernels which already exist in EC2, this is the one I want you to load. So you can say, I want the Ubuntu kernel, or I want the Red Hat kernel. There is still no way for EC2 users to actually upload their own kernels. Obviously, there is some way for Red Hat to upload kernels, but not normal people. Now, one of the issues with Xen and getting support here is x86 is really a nasty architecture as far as virtualization goes. The standard way to virtualize any sort of platform is called the trap and emulate method, where any instructions which do anything sensitive will, when you're running it without privilege, will trap, and then the kernel, microkernel, hypervisor, will say, okay, you were trying to do this, I will emulate this instruction so that it looks to you like it actually worked. And then when it's finished emulating it, loading fake registers, whatever, then it goes back, returns back into user land, which to your kernel makes it just look like that instruction took a bit longer than it normally does. Problem with x86, there's non-privileged instructions which reveal sensitive CPU state. The instructions which write these registers, those all trap, but the instructions which read them don't necessarily trap. This causes problems in the cases where you want to read a register, flip a bit, and then store it back, because what you want to be doing is storing back your version of this register, but you're in fact reading the version from the actual CPU, not your emulated version. Even worse problem in x86, there are some instructions which just silently behave differently depending upon whether you're running in privileged mode. One example of this is the pop flags instruction. If you're running with privileges, it will set certain privileged flags based on the value that you're writing. If you're running without privileges, it will set the unprivileged flags, and it will just ignore the values that you were trying to store to the privileged flags. So there's no way for a hypervisor to emulate this because it never traps. The way that Xen deals with this, it uses pair virtualization. The idea here is, instead of just emulating things, you rely on modifying the operating system so that instead of running these sensitive instructions, which in some cases don't trap, you make a call to the hypervisor saying, I would like to store these flags. Please pretend to store these flags for me. Intel and AMD added these new features, VTX and AMDV, to their CPUs in order to make virtualization a lot easier, essentially to fix the problems that have been in x86 for a long time. Xen uses these in the HVM mode, but unfortunately EC2 was around before HVM became available, and EC2 still works using pair virtualization. So the next roadblock I ran into was FreeBSD's Xen support. In late 2004, Kip Macy published some patches to add FreeBSD support, to add Xen support into FreeBSD. About a year later, he became a FreeBSD committer, and he started working on this in FreeBSD's Perforce repository. Does anybody here like Perforce? Yes. Okay. There are not many people here who like Perforce. The Perforce repository is rather like a sewer. Sometimes things will crawl out of it, but usually nobody wants to look in there, and things that go in there just stay in there and slowly rot. This sort of happened to the Xen code. In 2008, the Xen code was committed to the FreeBSD SVN repository, which did mean that it was now available. When you checked out a source tree, you would get it. You didn't have to go look somewhere special. But by this point, it had rotted for about 3 years, and it really didn't work very well, which contributed to it not getting any testing. In addition, by this point, most people had moved away from i386 and onto MV64. Most people had stopped using Power Virtualization and were using HVM. So even people who were interested in Xen weren't actually testing this code. So it just continued to slowly rot. People would make changes to the rest of the tree and not update the Xen code. The code was not in a very good state when I came around to looking at it later. The next problem is with Xen itself. EC2 uses a version of Xen which requires its paging tables to be set up in a particular way. This has something to do with recursive page mappings, which some people here know a lot about, and I do not know a lot about. FreeBSD's Xen code does not do it the way that EC2 likes. Newer versions of Xen are okay with this. But the version of Xen which EC2 is using expects paging tables to be done the way that Linux does paging tables, because Xen people were Linux people, really. August of 2008, Kip told me I should be able to do this in the next couple of weeks. Only problem here is he got a lot of high-paying contract work and decided that getting paid was worth a lot more than not getting paid. So I figured, if he wants to get paid to do this work, maybe we can find some money for him to get paid to do this work. So I put out a call on my blog and asked, did anybody want to get FreeBSD into EC2 and have any money, any big companies out there? And I heard this a lot. We can't spend any money on experimental work, but once it's working, we might be able to contribute something. Slight chicken and egg problem here. Once it's working, we don't actually need the money that much. So last year I decided to take a detour. NetBSD runs on everything, right? In particular, NetBSD's Power Virtualized Xen code was in a much better condition than FreeBSD's code. I sent an email to some NetBSD developers April of last year, asking them about their Xen code, how they did their paging tables, stuff like that. And last year here at BSD CAN, I managed to launch and SSH into a NetBSD instance. I was about 30 minutes too late with my work in progress slides. Robert told me, no, you cannot give me your slides 5 minutes before the work in progress session starts. And George is going to say the same thing to anybody who does that this year. A couple months after this, the NetBSD instance that I had produced that was working perfectly fine stopped working. I don't know why. I asked people at Amazon, did you change anything? And they didn't tell me. So they may have changed. Well, I assume they changed something, because there must be something that changed to make it stop working, but I don't know what happened. But fortunately, I did manage to get a NetBSD developer interested in this, and he has got NetBSD running again on 64-bit EC2 instances, currently only with one core, which makes it not particularly useful since all of the 64-bit EC2 instances have several cores. But you can launch it in there and use one core and the others will just sit idle. There is currently work sponsored by the NetBSD Foundation to get NetBSD working with SMP on Xen. I'm not sure exactly when that's going to be finished, but sometime this year you should be able to launch NetBSD on EC2 and use all of the cores that you want. So that's all the things that went wrong. Now I'll start talking about the things that started working right. November 2008, Doug Rabson started working on AMD64 Xen HVM. I mentioned before, HVM was the way that people wanted to go, AMD64, of course, as well. People liked having extra bits in their words. Interesting thing here is that the work on HVM actually involved a lot of work on power virtualized Xen because of the drivers. Even though HVM supports full virtualization, where all of the hardware is emulated and you can take a standard FreeBSD release, that's compiled without any Xen support at all and booted on an HVM system. HVM is often used with Power Virtual rather than emulated hardware. And there's some good reasons for this. First, Power Virtual devices are almost always a lot faster than emulated hardware. If you think about it, code which is designed to talk to other code tends to be better than code which is trying to talk to hardware, which is ending up talking to code which is pretending to be hardware. The other issue, hardware emulation has a very poor record for security. There's been a number of issues with code emulating devices, emulated network cards, emulated frame buffers. I think there was a bug in an emulated keyboard at one point. A lot of this emulation code was not really written with the thought in mind that you would be running hostile code on here. It was written so that you could, launch another operating system on your laptop and play your Windows games while you're running Linux, stuff like that. But for the cloud, of course, if you're running a cloud computing service, you want to make sure that one customer can't take over your entire service. The AMD 64 HVM code is now very stable. It's being used in storage appliances, costing large amounts of money that need to be very, very reliable. And fortunately for FreeBSD, between December 2009 and October 2010, Justin Gibbs brought a long list of patches back to our Xen Power Virtual drivers from his company where they are doing this work. So at this point, at least the drivers are working fairly well. The problem is just the core Power Virtual bits in terms of dealing with the CPU and the memory mapping. Another nice thing that happened last year, Amazon released a PVGrub kernel image. This is a Power Virtualized version of the Grub bootloader, so it can be loaded the way that a Xen kernel can be loaded, but it in fact has all of the code or most of the code from Grub to be able to load another kernel. Unlike Xen, it actually knows how to read a file system, so you can give it a disk and say, go read a configuration file, go find the kernel, go load it into memory. At least as long as the file system is ext2. I understand that there are actually extension modules which can be loaded in order to teach it about other file systems, but the version that EC2 is using doesn't seem to understand these. It doesn't seem to have them loaded, at least. So the strategy for getting BSD onto EC2, given that we can't just load a FreeBSD kernel, is you bundle an AMI which has the PVGrub, quote, kernel, and has two disk images. The first one is ext2 formatted and has the grub metadata and then the kernel, the FreeBSD kernel that you want to load. And then the second disk has everything else, your FreeBSD world, also your kernel modules. I made a mistake when I was working on this once. I put all of the kernel modules onto the same disk as the kernel, which normally sounds reasonable, and then I realized when it tried to boot, it's very difficult to load the ext2 kernel module off of a file system which is ext2 formatted. So now we just need to have a FreeBSD kernel which is compatible with the version of Xen that they're using. Well, November 11th of 2010, I tried launching a FreeBSD Xen kernel on a T1 micro instance. This is a fairly new type of instance. It's smaller than the original small instances. Instead of having about half a CPU, it has about a tenth of a CPU. It also has less RAM. And it costs a lot less. It's about 2 cents instead of 10 cents per hour. I did have a reason for doing this, but I can't tell you what the reason was that I decided to try this. And that's what I saw, which looks pretty good until you get to that point. But once I was getting some output to the console, I at least had a way to start doing some debugging. So I spent the next month or so tracking down various panics. The code did things like asserting that the fifth element of a four-element array had the right value. That didn't go down very well. It was mapping pages when processes were created and then not unmapping them later when the process was destroyed. This results in page mapping just lingering along, and then suddenly you decide you want to map that somewhere else, and the kernel gets unhappy. It was trying to unpin pages which were never pinned. This is something that you do in Zen to tell it that this is a page table which is going to stay a page table even though it's not actually hooked up to the master page tables at the moment. This is because Zen needs to validate page tables when they're activated. So it's a way to reduce the cost of context switches by having it not need to revalidate pages later. At one point we were flushing the TLB cache before we updated some page mappings rather than after we updated the page mappings, which had the nice effect that we flush the cache, and then it reloads the old value again, and then we change the value, and of course it's still got the old value in the cache. At one point we were using a page for per CPU data structures, but we never actually told the VM code that this page was being used for this. So it works fine until you start using a lot of memory, and then suddenly the VM code says, well, we've got this free page, let's allocate it to something. And suddenly your pure CPU data structures get completely overwritten. This causes problems. My favorite bug here, we were enabling interrupts before we installed an interrupt handler. It turns out that null is not very good at handling interrupts. The first three of these bugs, interestingly enough, only happened when running with the PAE option. This is probably why they existed in the first place. PAE is a rather nasty feature of Intel and AMD CPUs. It's called physical address extension. This was added in the Pentium Pro in order to allow 32-bit operating systems to access more than 4 gigabytes of RAM. I've heard rumors about three-letter agencies that may or may not have been responsible for getting this feature added because of the systems they were building. I don't know if these are actually true, but I have no difficulty believing them. So you still have 32-bit virtual addresses, so any individual process can only access 4 gigabytes of RAM at a time, but your physical addresses are longer. And normally nobody ever uses this. By the time that people had 4 gigabytes of RAM, most of us had 64-bit CPUs. Most of us have less RAM per CPU than certain three-letter agencies. EC2, on the other hand, used PAE because they wanted to have multiple VMs, each of which having about 2 gigabytes of RAM, on the same physical machine. I think that their original machines had 8 gigs of RAM and had 4 virtual machines on each. Now, the thing you have to realize here is because EC2 uses Power Virtualized Zen, the guest operating system needs to do its paging tables the same way as the host operating system, because the guest operating system's paging tables are, in fact, paging tables that get used. So the guest also has to use PAE, even though the guest has less than 4 gigs of RAM, and normally with less than 4 gigs of RAM, you don't bother with PAE. Now, once I got FreeBSD booting into user land, the next step was to make it act like an EC2 instance acts. That turned out to be fairly straightforward. EC2 instances boot via DHCP, they get their IP addresses, so you just throw that into rcconf. They normally have SSH enabled. Of course, you launch a machine, you need to get in there and do something. Just throw that into rcconf. EC2 instances, you need to have some way to log into them, and if you have a standard image that everybody's using, you need to find some way that you can log in and not everybody else. So EC2 has a mechanism where when you launch an instance, you can tell it, this is the public key I want to be using to log into that instance. and it makes it available for the instance in some special metadata that it can download via HTTP. So I just wrote an extra RCD script which fetches the key and installs it as Root's SSH key. Of course, in the FreeBSD world, we normally don't log in as Root. In the Linux world, they seem to like this. EC2 comes from a Linux background, of course. That was the first thing that they supported. So to make things compatible with how people expected EC2 to work, I enabled Root logins. I would recommend if you use EC2, you should disable those and find some other way to do things. But in order to be the way that people expected at first, I enabled that. And, of course, when you launch a machine, the first thing it does, or one of the first things it does, is generate SSH host keys. You want to find out what those host keys are so that you can make sure you're logging into that machine. So they have a console that you can read from, and they print out their host keys to that console in a particular format for their tools to recognize. So let's just throw in another RCD script which prints those keys in the right format. So once I'd gotten the user land working the way it ought, obviously there are more bugs I needed to resolve. For some reason, the nanosecond precision Zen time counter was being rounded to 10 millisecond increments. This makes the kernel time counting very unhappy because it expects that if you tell it you've got a nanosecond precision timer, it will actually increment in nanoseconds. So the fix was just take out that line of code that did the rounding. I don't know why it was in there in the first place. During some page table manipulations, FreeBSD was writing to the Zen debug log. I have a feeling that this was some debug code left over by the person who wrote this code, but it slowed down fork by about a factor of 30. So I took out that one line of code, and suddenly fork was 30 times faster. My favorite peculiarity in the code, there's a comment, "This is not strictly correct." I deleted that code, and it stopped panicking. I do not know why it was there in the first place. So all this work up to this point was only on T1 micro instances, which they're nice systems to have for some purposes, but they're pretty puny. It's enough for a small website, or maybe your personal mail server, depending upon how much spam you receive. Probably good enough for a DNS server. It's really too slow to be doing any port building locally. I built Apache on one of these, and it took 5 hours. So if you do use these, I recommend building your packages somewhere else, uploading them, and installing those packages. Or you could just use the packages built by the FreeBSD project, of course. There is one thing it will do very quickly, which is it will panic if you try to use ZFS. ZFS does not like i386, and it definitely does not like having only 600 megabytes of RAM. I've been told you really should not try to use ZFS with less than about 1 or 2 gigs of RAM. 600 megs gives you panics very quickly. Now, I mentioned before Amazon uses power virtualization for Zen. There's actually one instance which uses hardware virtualization instead. This is their so-called cluster compute instance, which is a lot more powerful. 8 cores, 23 gigs of RAM, a bit over a terabyte of local disk. These are designed for people who are doing really high-performance computing, people who are running bioinformatics computations, oil companies dealing with seismic data, stuff like that. It's, in addition to what I have written here, these instances actually, they're running on boxes with 10 gigabit Ethernet connecting them. So if you want to have a really high-performance cluster, you get 40 of these instances, and you can do a lot with them. Before they announced this, they actually took all of these all of our available cluster compute instances and ran the Linpack benchmark on it, and I think it was somewhere around 200th on the top 500 supercomputer list. So yes, you too can own a top 500 supercomputer for a few hours if you're willing to pay several thousand dollars. I got a FreeBSD image working on this on March 22nd, and I'm very happy to say I actually got paid for it. The biggest problem here, I mentioned before, HVM generally worked very well. The biggest problem was dealing with FreeBSD's UART driver, because there's a bug in the version of Xen which Amazon's using. Their UART emulation code sometimes forgot to send interrupts. And FreeBSD's UART code says, well, we'll fill this buffer and then we'll just wait for an interrupt before we send any more data. So the console would write 16 bytes and then you would never see anything more on the console. It turns out that this bug was actually fixed in Xen a bit more than a year ago, but Amazon likes using old versions of Xen.
Wasn't that just a faithful reproduction of an actual hardware bug?
It might be. I've never heard of that hardware bug, but it is possible. So debugging things in the cloud is a lot different from debugging things on physical hardware. There's some good things and there's some bad things about this. Until I could SSH into a FreeBSD instance, every time I wanted to try something new, it involved building a new disk image on my build box, SCPing it across the internet over to a Linux instance that was running on EC2, writing it from there onto a virtual disk, snapshotting that disk, bundling a new Amazon machine image out of that snapshot, and then launching that Amazon machine image as an EC2 instance. This had a round trip time of about half an hour. In addition to that, the EC2 console is output only. Normally with FreeBSD, when you get a panic, you go into the debugger and you try to figure out what happened. This was not possible. Instead, I got very good at debugging via printf. When it takes you half an hour to print out one value, you figure out which value you want to get printed out. There are some nice things. If you manage to make your VM unable to boot, such as if you install a broken kernel, which I did on several occasions, what you can do is detach its disks, boot up another instance, attach them to that instance, log in there, fix things, detach disks, attach them back to the original instance, and boot it up again. Of course, you can do this with physical hardware, but you need a screwdriver to do that. With a cloud system, all you need is a web browser. Also, if you have a bug which doesn't happen all that often, like all sorts of race conditions in, say, PMAP code, rather than struggling to figure out where it's happening, you can just spin up 100 machines, and then it is no longer a rarely occurring bug, it is a very frequently occurring bug. If you tried to tell your boss that you needed to buy 100 servers to help you debug something, you probably wouldn't have very much luck. But if you told him, I need to spend $1 an hour to debug something, I don't think he'd have much trouble with that. Nice thing about working in the cloud with elastic capabilities is you can scale up to 100 machines, then you can scale down when you're finished debugging, and you don't need to actually buy the hardware, you just rent it for a few hours. So, some lessons I learned by this process. First, keeping up to date with the latest fashions tends to be very important. If your last company left in the world, which is running a very ancient version of Xen, people will not be very inclined to support your platform. They may say, gee, there's not much point updating or un-updating our code to work on the version of Xen that you need so that we have our ancient PMAP code back. They may just say, it's not worth paying that much money to do that work. We'll just go somewhere else which supports HVM. One of the best ways to kill an open source project is to hire one of its lead developers and tell them to work on something else, like network stack drivers. Another way to halt the project in its tracks is to have him arrested. I'm not going to say any more about that. it's probably not worth porting an operating system to a new platform unless there's actually a community which is going to be using it and making sure it doesn't break. Kip did this work porting FreeBSD to Xen back in 2004, and it really was not used very much. It is still not used very much, but now a few people are using it. But for 5-6 years, I suspect that nobody was using it, because for long periods of time, it didn't even build, never mind run. If you have people actually trying to use the code, then when someone updates it somewhere else in the tree and breaks Xen code and Xen support, someone's going to notice it, and someone's going to complain, and it is likely to get fixed. And finally, it's a lot easier to get people to pay for work once you've already done most of the work for free. So the current state of FreeBSD on EC2, it's reasonably stable on T1 micro instances, which, as I mentioned before, are very puny. So useful for some things, but not for most things. It is stable with some minor patches, the UART patch being the most significant one. On the cluster compute instances, these of course are very powerful, but also have a price that matches. I think these cost about $1.60 per hour. It doesn't work on any of the other EC2 instance types. The other 32-bit instances, there are issues, most of which I can't talk about. The 64-bit instances just don't work because FreeBSD does not have 64-bit Xen support. 9.0 current is unstable on T1 micro because of some locking problems in the PMAP code. I understand that at the developer summit, someone decided that he was going to work on this. This makes me very happy because it means I don't need to work on this. It does, however, work perfectly fine on the cluster compute instances because that doesn't rely on paravirtual Xen. That's just the same page mapping code as we have in standard FreeBSD AMD 64. Each day, somewhere around 5 to 15 FreeBSD instances get launched. In the AMIs I published, I have an RCD script which says, if this is the first time this is being booted, send Colin an email. And this is how many emails I get. Now, people can take these images and modify them, remove that RCD script, or just remove the rcconf entry. So there may be more than this. I know some people have bundled their own AMIs based on my work. But it is at least that many instances being launched each day. One of the other things I added to this is an RCD script which sends me an email every time it reboots after a panic. Again, this is specified in rcconf. You can disable it. You can have it send them to a different email address. But I decided it would be very useful for me to see how stable this code was. By default, it sends them to me. Over half of the panics that I've seen from 8.2 release have the same backtrace going through ARP. I don't think this actually has anything to do with EC2 because it occurs outside of EC2. In fact, this PR, when it was first reported, someone thought it was a problem with the BCE network driver. I have a feeling if it occurs in BCE and it occurs in EC2, it's probably not the same bug.
There's a fix for that already.
Okay, wonderful.
John already fixed that. That's a lacking issue. We looked at it last night.
Okay.
It just didn't get...
I will merge that and I will release a new AMI soon. When I wrote these slides, it was about 2 days ago, and at that point, it was not fixed yet. Almost all of the other panics that I see are malloc failures when people are trying to use ZFS. I say almost all because there is one panic that I have reported which is going through geom, and it seems to be involving geom devices disappearing and the kernel getting confused. I'm not sure if that's related to EC2 or some other bug, but it's only happened once, so I'm not going to bother investigating it until it happens again. Future work on FreeBSD EC2, the PMAP code needs to be locked properly in 9 current so that we can actually have a 9.0 release which is usable on EC2. It sounds like someone's going to be doing this work. If that doesn't happen, I'll find some time to work on it, probably. There's some peculiar clock issues on T1 micro instances, which I want to investigate at some point. Sometimes this system just sort of falls asleep, and it doesn't do anything until it wakes up with an interrupt, which really has to be network traffic, because there's nothing else to interrupt it. The ULE scheduler often stalls. The BSD scheduler seems to be fine, so it may be a difference between some problem with the ULE scheduler, but I think it's more likely that ULE just is more sensitive to having a broken clock. TOP shows some wildly bogus CPU values, like this process is using 1,000,000% CPU. It looks like the problem is that clock interrupts are getting lost somewhere. All of the problems seem to be consistent with the FreeBSD kernel telling Zen, I'm finished with everything I can do right now, please wake me up at the next clock tick, and that clock tick just not happening, or possibly happening, and somehow the FreeBSD kernel is losing it. So I need to investigate what's going on there. But there is a workaround at the moment, which is set up a machine somewhere else on the internet and ping your EC2 instance every second, because any network traffic will wake it up. So that will make sure that your machine doesn't fall asleep for an hour, like sometimes these instances have been seen to do.
Are you running these
single core? Yeah, T1 Micro is a single core. The I386 Zen code probably does not work on SMP. I haven't actually tried it on SMP, but there's enough comments saying this is probably broken on SMP that I think it is probably broken on an SMP. So bringing FreeBSD to more EC2 instance types, of course, is something that I want to do. Currently, there's about a factor of 100 in performance between T1 Micro and cluster compute. It would be nice to have something somewhere in the middle of that range. The big thing here is we really want to have support for AMD 64 paravirtualized Zen, because most of the EC2 instance types now are 64 bits, and obviously the world is going more and more towards 64-bit everything. So getting 32-bit working completely would be nice, but it's still not the best of solutions. Any questions? Yes?
Is Amazon going to ever update Zen or support HTML5
types? That is a good question. It is a question that I have asked Amazon numerous times, and I don't think my NDA prevents me from saying that they did not answer that question. I think at some point they will have to, because the version of Zen that they are using is very, very old, and I have heard that some other systems, some new Linux distributions, have had problems with their old version of Zen. The only problem with that is that some of the currently running versions of Linux on EC2 have problems with newer versions of Zen. So I'm not quite sure how they're going to solve this problem, but certainly it is a problem that they will have to deal with at some point. Now, as far as bringing HVM to more instance types, I'm speculating here, but I would suspect that the reason that they haven't done this yet is security, because with emulated hardware, there have been a lot of security issues, and even using paravirtual devices, there are still some things that are emulated. So, speaking as a security officer, if I was running EC2, I would probably not want to provide HVM support for other instance types. The thing about the cluster compute is, with those instances, you have the complete machine, so it doesn't matter that much if you can break out of the Zen jail, because there's no other machines no other virtual machines, no other customers on that same hardware for you to mess with. Yes.
Stu, on the
Each instance has a specific amount of memory. So the T1 micro has about 600 megabytes. The cluster compute instances have 23 gigabytes, and everything else is in the middle between there. I should say that there are some specific high memory instances which are designed for running databases, which have, I think it's up to about 64 gigs.
And then specifically for those that you would be offering, the FreeBSD is applicable to. So it's only the T1 micro.
It's the T1 micro with 600 megs and the cluster compute with 23 gigs at the moment. Yes? I've loaded them pretty heavily. I mean, there's a limit to how much load you can put onto a system with 600 megs of RAM because you can't run more processes than you can fit into memory. But you're running a make index -J32. That bogs the system down pretty heavily. When I do that on 9 current, I get about 0.6 panics per hour. So with 8.2 release running something like 500 CPU hours, I didn't see any panics doing that. So there's certainly it's a lot more stable.
Are you putting
any client in terms of running a lot of traffic, do you mean?
Yeah.
I haven't thrown a lot of traffic at it. It's going to be limited by the fact that you don't have very much CPU time. It's 0 point CPUs, but it's burstable. So If you're running a web server or something, you get a request, and you can handle that request. But if you're doing anything intensive for more than a couple of seconds, you get throttled back a lot.
What about the larger configurations?
Oh, with the cluster compute, I've done lots of stuff on there, and I know people using EC2 who have thrown a lot of bandwidth at that, and that seems fine. You can try talking to me. I don't actually know a lot about the drivers. Justin was doing most of the work on those.
I'm looking forward a little bit to the 130 talk I'm going to get, but I'm going to discuss one of them.
Justin is probably the person you want to talk to. If you can't find him, you can try talking to me. I can try to answer your questions, but as I say, I don't know a lot about the driver side of things. The failures look like absolutely nothing. There is nothing on the console. It boots, or sometimes it boots and does nothing. Sometimes it boots and immediately shuts down. I have seen this same behavior with old versions of Zen, so it's a problem with the way that we do page mappings. Yes and no. I think they run a rather customized system, so you can set up something which is sort of vaguely similar to what they have, but you can't get something which is identical.
And what version of Zen? Are they still 2-something?
They're a bit newer than that. I don't think I can tell you the exact version, but... Okay, if there's no other questions, does anybody want to see me launch an EC2 instance running FreeBSD?
Yes.
Okay. I haven't actually done this here, but I think somewhere there's a web browser. So this is Amazon Web Services, and I'm not going to show you how to create an account, but you click sign up now, and it's fairly straightforward. You can come into the management console, and let's see if I can remember the password I use here. I click launch instance. And this console is rather silly. It downloads the complete list of AMIs, which is, I don't know, 50,000 or so AMIs, and then filters them. So it takes a while. I think the Amazon developers who wrote this were on Amazon's internal network, which was a lot faster. So here we see all of the AMIs I have published. I keep on bugging Amazon. It shows up as other Linux, but they haven't added a FreeBSD category yet. And this here, by the way, this star here means that it is able to run on a T1 micro instance, which if you are a new Amazon Web Services user, meaning you create your account now or in the past few months, you can use this for free for the next year. And I want to run it on micro because that's the only place it does work. I'm going to proceed without a key pair because I don't think we have SSH on here, so I can't show you SSHing in. My instance is now launching. And it shows here as pending. And in about a minute, it will become running. And one annoying thing about EC2 actually is the console lags a bit. It takes a couple minutes between when stuff is written to the console and when it shows up and can be accessed through the management interface. So we'll have to wait a few minutes before we can actually see FreeBSD having booted. Does anybody have any other questions while we wait for this? Yes?
So if finally Amazon upgrades the version of Xen, then it will be easier to launch different instances
with a new version of Xen, it should be possible to run FreeBSD on all of the 32-bit instances modulo the possibility. There's other bugs I haven't found yet. But certainly the hard part will be solved for other 32-bit instances. So that's the small instance which has half a CPU and 1.7 gigs of RAM, and the high CPU medium instance, which is two CPUs or two cores, and I think it's the same, 1.7 gigs of RAM. So yes, it says it's running now, and if I right-click here, it allows get system log. I'm not going to do that yet because it won't show me anything, and it caches the having not got anything, which would take longer to wait for, so we'll just wait a bit longer. Yes? That one, it was 10 cents per hour when it launched, and now it's 8.5 cents per hour. The micro instance costs 2 cents per hour. All of these actually can be reduced. Amazon allows you to ask for spot instances. They have this idea of the spot market for CPU time. Spot instances, with normal instances, you get the instance, and then it stays there until you tell it to die. Spot instances, you say, I want to pay this much per hour for my instance, and it will launch when the price on the market is below that, and if someone else is willing to pay more, then your instance just dies. So it's not something you want to use for running a web server, but if you've got some batch compute jobs that you want to do, and you don't really care when they happen, as long as they happen sometime in the next week, using spot instances could actually work out very well for that and save you a lot of money.
So a 24/7 instance of a small one would be at $60 a month or something?
Yes.
When you say they die when the spot market goes higher, do you mean the machine is killed or suspended until the market comes down?
I believe that the instance is just killed.
So your job would better be something that checkpoints?
Yes. And often it's used by people who are doing MapReduce jobs, which do their own checkpointing internally, of course.
I suppose you could use S3 for the checkpoint.
Yes.
All right. quite as well as Chrome. One thing to keep in mind, though, you will be charged based on IOs and stuff. So if you have processes constantly, reading off the disk and writing to the disk, and you forget about it, you come back a month later, then you'll have to know when to go or bill or whatever.
Yeah. So with EC2, there's two ways of doing disk. In all the instances apart from Micro, have local disks attached to them, which is a disk on the same box which is hosting the instance. You can also attach elastic block store devices, where you can specify whatever size of disk you want, and you pay per gigabyte for the storage, and then you also have to pay for IOs for those because they're going over the network to some storage array somewhere. Incidentally, the outage about two weeks ago was with the elastic block store. It wasn't actually EC2, so anybody who was only using the local storage was fine at that point.
Are there any real competitors yet to this service, and would they be friendlier to FreeBSD?
It depends how you define competitors. There's a lot of cloud platforms out there, but they aren't really as elastic as Amazon. So Rackspace, for instance, has a cloud platform, but in order to get a new instance, you go into their billing system and you say, I want to have a new virtual machine, and then 6 hours later they say, okay, here's your machine, and by the way, you're paying for the next month. Whereas with Amazon, you pay by the hour, you can spin up an instance, and this one's probably finished writing here. There you go, FreeBSD has booted. So you can spin up an instance and start using it 2 minutes later, and then you can shut it down and you don't pay for the rest of the month. It's rounded up to the next hour. I don't think this system has SSH.
There wasn't. You can't log through the web page management or something.
No, that just tells you this is what you want to do if you want to get in via SSH. So you can actually see here at the top here, this is the PV grub running. Is that easy to read there? Okay, I'll highlight things for you. So that's PV grub running, and then grub says, okay, let's find the FreeBSD kernel, and it runs with these options. Boot verbose doesn't actually need to be on. I had that on for debugging and never removed it. Mount from I have to specify because I'm telling it to boot off of the second disk rather than the first. Then FreeBSD kernel boots. It complains that it doesn't have loader metadata because it's not being run via the normal FreeBSD bootloader. But then it starts running normally, and it recognizes it's got a 2.6 gigahertz processor. It doesn't realize that it only has about a tenth of that. And you've got all the normal FreeBSD boot processes. It has the Xen virtual network driver. It has these two block devices, XBD0, which is attached as DA0, is the disk. It's a 1 gigabyte disk that only contains the FreeBSD kernel and grub metadata. It could be a lot smaller, except EBS disks have to be multiples of 1 gigabyte, so there's a bit of wasted space there. And then I've got a 9 gig disk for FreeBSD World. FreeBSD boots up normally. It gets its address via DHCP. It downloads, it tries to download an SSH key, but I didn't actually tell it to use one, so it says there isn't anything here. It gets its host keys, and then this is the format that EC2 instances normally print out their SSH host keys in. And then it's finished booting. This is a micro instance, which is 2 cents per hour, about 50 cents. It's about just less than $15 a month. And of course, if you were creating a new account now, it would be free.
Yeah.
The disk I/O costs $1 per 10 million IOs, which it's actually quite difficult to get that to add up to very much.
So for an IRC server, I'm looking at $15 a month.
Yes. Well, it thinks it's running a pvgrub kernel, which, I mean, obviously they realize nobody is just running grub. People use this to load kernels, and they announced it as here is pvgrub. You can use this to boot your own kernels. So they realize that people are running a variety of things with it. The name attached to the AMI is FreeBSD EC2. So obviously they can see that it's FreeBSD that's running.
So if you, you did this through a web GUI, are there also tools?
There's command line tools for all sorts of things. Everything I did here is in the command line. Also the tools for registering AMIs, for instance. Yes, in fact, EC2 also has, no, you can't see it on this interface, but there is, maybe it is here. Yes, there is Amazon CloudWatch, which is a system for monitoring your EC2 instances, and it can do auto-scaling for you. So you can set it up so that, I don't know if it... No, under FreeBSD, you probably can't figure out what your CPU load is, but there are actually ways that you can have custom metrics that you can provide to it. So it is possible to set it up so that the system will automatically launch new instances for you when your load gets too high, and then also kill off instances when you don't need them anymore. So it is designed to make it very easy to scale up and scale down automatically. Well, you saw it right here. It took about 4 minutes before I got that on the console, and it was about a minute for FreeBSD to boot. So it does scale up as quickly as the traffic will, unless, I guess if you're mentioned on TV and the entire country sees it live, you might have a problem. But for most situations, you'll have no trouble scaling up fast enough. Okay, I don't see any other questions. So go enjoy the rest of the conference.